Hi, everyone, and welcome to the newest episode of Upzoned, a Strong Towns podcast. Or rather, almost welcome. I'm going to give you a little disclaimer before we start this one today. We had some very light issues with audio on this particular recording, thanks to a little something called the internet. I don't know if you know this, but Strong Towns is a fully remote organization, and what that means is that when we record these, Chuck is sitting in his living room in Brainerd, Minnesota. I'm in my living room in St. Louis, Missouri, and sometimes things don't go exactly as planned. I've been told it's not too distracting, a little bit of light crackling, maybe the occasional speeding up on Chuck's audio specifically, but I played this for some colleagues at Strong Towns and they said this is a good enough conversation to go ahead and push out anyway. So go ahead and give it a listen. Let us know what you think. And thanks so much for being a part of the Strong Towns movement. Welcome to Upzoned. Hey everyone, and welcome to Upzoned, your weekly deep dive into just one story from the Strong Towns conversation. This is Kia Wilson, and I'm here with my friend Chuck Marone, our president. How are you doing today, Chuck?
I'm doing fantastic. It's gorgeous. Well, I say this, it's completely overcast and cold in Minnesota, but it's fall. So like, right. What, you know, to me, we had like such a hot week last week. And I'm like, now we're into fall and I like it. So I'm doing fantastic.
Yeah. I love that we always start with the weather report on this podcast.
We're Midwestern.
I know. Exactly. Uh-huh. I'm like, I can't complain. You know, it's like, I have a lot of things to complain about in St. Louis, but instead I'm going to talk about the fact that it's only 89 degrees on September 15th. Yeah. So could be worse. So speaking of St. Louis and other Rust Belt cities, we've got a piece we're here going to upzone today, actually from Reuters. And Chuck, I was hoping that you could kind of intro this one because you brought it to my attention. And I said, Chuck, I have 50 million thoughts on this. Let's have a conversation. It is called How Tech Jobs Helped the Rust Belt, oh, there's a typo in this headline, right, become house flipping hotspots. Tell me a little bit about why you wanted to talk about this one, Chuck.
There's something very interesting going on in the Rust Belt today, especially in these, you know, these forgotten cities. You know, we're doing some work in Akron right now. I think this place epitomizes it. St. Louis certainly does. In the article, they feature a lot in Cleveland and Pittsburgh. These are all cities that, like, prosperity in a sense passed by in this boom we had on the coast. This is the flyover country, the parts that narrative in the 2016 election of places being downtrodden and the hillbilly elegy kind of country. Yet it doesn't take really much looking, and this article kind of highlights this a little bit, to see all kinds of potential and to see people really making amazing use out of it. I think the tech part of this is kind of an interesting side note, but what I found about this article that was fascinating is, unlike the, we call it paper wealth, that was happening in Florida and California and Vegas and up along the West Coast, in terms of like just flat out more people bidding on the same junky house, just driving it up in price to insane levels, what you see in these Rust Belt cities that are seeing this renaissance is people going in and with, you know, their hard work and their sweat equity and, getting down on their knees and sanding stuff and pulling out the paintbrush and fixing up rooms, they're creating immense value in old neglected properties. And then able to, because of the neglect that was there and the really kind of low point of entry that existed, they're able to turn those out and make a really good profit at it, essentially make a really good living. What they're calling house flipping, what I think, like, historically we just call, you know, being a carpenter or being a contractor. I think that this is a story that is untold and unsung, and I just wanted to highlight it a little bit because I think it's a great success story that you're only really finding in those specific kind of places.
I think we're in for a little bit of a debate on this podcast, Chuck. I really do. Yeah, I'm excited because, well, yes and no. I agree with you. And as someone who has spent almost my entire life in the Rust Belt besides, I guess it was 6 years in New Mexico and Maryland, I have seen, and to some extent I have done, the kind of work that you're describing. As regular readers of the site will know, I am a small-time developer, technically. I'm not a flipper in the sense that my goal with the buildings that I own 6 apartments here in St. Louis, is not to sell them at a higher profit. It's to create long-term buy and hold rentals. But, you know, I know lots of people who have flipped houses here and done it exactly in the way that you describe. I also know a lot of people who have flipped houses who it doesn't look like, you know, someone coming in with a tool belt and some sweat equity and a dream glittering in their eye. It looks like an out-of-state developer buying up an entire block or in sometimes an entire neighborhood of vacant properties, speculating on it, letting it sit, and then doing the flipping after the neighborhood has completely degraded. And, you know, flipping exists on a spectrum. And for me, there were some things in this article that I was like, you're pointing to this as like a great thing that, you know, within these neighborhoods that have been historically disinvested, we're seeing more investment. And I think that's absolutely true. I want there to be more investment in St. Louis, in my hometown of Cleveland, which factors like in a huge way in this article. But I also recognize that sometimes there's a long period of disinvestment directly at the hands of people who are using real estate as part of their investment portfolio before we see cities come back to life. And sometimes they never come back to life. Often these cities are, these would-be flipped properties are reclaimed by the Land Reutilization Authority before that ever happens. I'm curious why you have a more optimistic view of it.
I look at like Oswego, New York, which is a place where I've been. Paul Stewart was on my podcast a couple of years ago. I think doing just genius work there. And what they're doing is they're spending little bits of money to leverage essentially outside visually, improvements that you can see from the street as a way to, and his term was, stop the bank run on confidence that exists in these neighborhoods. But the underlying that strategy, because that strategy would not work in, say, the outskirts of Phoenix. It works in Oswego, New York, because the housing stock there is so good. It's so solid. You see this in Buffalo. You see this in a place like South Bend, where a good friend of mine named Scott Ford lives in, and Scott would be embarrassed for me to say this, but like lives in a mansion, really. It's just this gorgeous, gorgeous, beautiful house that he got for a song, and him and his wife renovated it. They've got 2 kids now. This housing stock in these areas and the neighborhoods are old, they're disinvested, they're run down, but they really just need a little bit of buffing and shining, and they come right back. The reason it excites me so much is because we're talking about dollar amounts that like average people could get into, poor people could get into. I mean, we're talking about houses you can get for $40,000, $50,000, up to $100,000, and that you can, with a little bit of money and just a lot of effort, move these things to something else. And I'd like to get into the outside money because I think that's one, you know, interesting aspect of what you brought up, but I don't get how, you know, that is any different than really what you're doing, which on a personal level is, you know, buying places that you can, cause you're not a slumlord. Nope. I mean, you're not buying things on their way down and then riding it down to the bottom and trying to cash flow it along the way. You're saying like, I live in this neighborhood. There's a house for sale. I'm going to acquire it. I'm going to, you know, own this long-term. And so I'm going to fix it up and maintain it and improve it as I can and build wealth for myself and my family. I feel like that opportunity now with the way that, you know, these cities are shifting is actually an opportunity again, where maybe it hadn't been for a number of decades.
I hope it's an opportunity. I will say that the myth, I think it's a little bit of a myth, at least in my town. I've never been to Oswego, New York, but the myth of a building that you can buy for $60,000 that just needs a little bit of buffing and shining and that a poor person can afford is less and less the reality, at least in the parts of the Rust Belt where I have spent time. These houses that go for $60,000 sometimes need $100,000 worth of work to be habitable in a basic way. And often you cannot get mortgages for them, or you can't get financing to do the vast scale of repairs that they need in order to make sure the pipes work and the roof isn't going to cave in unless you have a lot more money. That's something that was brought up in the article itself, is that funding for flippers is drying up. So the people who are staying in the game are the people who have the funds up front to devote to, you know, tearing off a facade that's crumbling and putting up a new one. The poor people in St. Louis generally cannot afford to buy these houses. And if they could, they're being preempted by large developers who are making package deals to the city saying, I'm going to buy, you know, 20 houses in this neighborhood that are currently being owned by the Land Reutilization Authority, and you're going to give it to me at a 20% discount. And that is seen as a win.
You brought up two issues there. And the first one I think is an interesting one. I'm going to say this and I'm going to say this in as nice a way as I can. When I look back at, like, you know, okay, I'll give you two examples. My dad once, when I was younger, bought a rental house or a house that they rented out. And this was something my grandfather did too. He owned like three or four rental properties in Brainerd. And he, you know, I would go a couple times on the rounds with him. We'd go meet and talk to these families and how are things going? And, you know, he would go take care of little things here and there. My dad tried to get in that business. Now, my grandpa grew up in the Depression, built a number of houses, kind of a handy guy. My dad, you know, I'm not gonna put him down because he's probably handier than me. But, you know, not certainly my grandfather. In terms of handiness. And my dad just gave up the game pretty quick because he's like, I got to hire an electrician. Like, I can't do this stuff myself. I got to hire a plumber. I can't [S2] Right. [S1] Do this stuff myself. Well, all of a sudden, yeah, like that changes everything. That really does. So when I say, you know, you come in and you got a little bit of buff and shine, I'm not talking about, you know, someone without like carpentry skills doing this. I'm talking about there's an opportunity for really like the old school contractor who kind of is a jack of all yeah. trades and can work on these projects to come in and make something happen. The other part though, about the people buying up the whole block, I think that is the thing that, yes, is that happening? Yeah. But it's not a phenomena you see throughout the Rust Belt and really, you know, most of the Midwest, the way you see it in southern states along the coast. And it's really a product of where the money's coming from. On Wall Street, you know, you can go today and put your money in a U.S. Treasury bond and get 0.5%. Or if you're willing to go 30 years and lose a lot of money long term or risk losing money long term, you can go 3.5% or 4%. But you can put your money into a real estate investment trust and get, you know, 4 or 5% on a shorter term and get your money back when you want to. That money is ending up in places like, you know, Charlotte and places like the outskirts of Orlando and places like California, where they're going out and buying up huge amounts of homes all at once and then doing the minimum amount needed to get them back like in a rental market. I don't know the exact situation you're describing. It sounds like some kind of like quasi government related thing.
More than quasi. Yeah.
So it's the government orchestrating this as like the local government as a way to take care of blight?
Yeah, I'm specifically talking about developers. This isn't a secret. It's all over the St. Louis news, like Paul McKee, who bought up huge tracts. I think over 30% of Northside St. Louis was given to him at once with tax increment financing supplied by the city. It was heralded as a historic deal 12 years ago, and the vast majority of those buildings have sat and crumbled, vacant. And it was his intention to flip them. It was his intention to put them back into productive use personally or get them fixed up. At least that's what he said, and sold to others. And what happened in reality is it crumbled and it crumbled until the National Geospatial Institute came in and said, we'll buy a huge chunk of these off of you and turn it into a campus. And did it on the exact site of Pruitt-Igoe, and they're completely replicating the failures of Pruitt-Igoe in that way. It didn't work out. And the idea that, you know, even if Paul McKee had come through on a lot of his promises, and he's not the only one in St. Louis, Nathan Cooper is another one that comes to mind, he's gotten a lot of press coverage around here. Would it have been the kind of development we advocate for at Strong Towns? Would it have been him rolling up his sleeves and, you know, doing the work at a low level to put these buildings back into productive use? No, it would have been transformation at a large scale. And I want the vision of this article to be true. It hasn't been true in most of my city.
Right. I feel like what you're describing is a, you know, is my guess is, and I don't know the precise details of this, but my guess is that the city unloaded it in this way for two reasons. One, it was easier. It's easier to deal with one person than, you know, a bunch of different property owners. And two, my guess is even with the tax increment financing is essentially giving up future tax revenues or folding them back into a project. My guess is they got some type of short-term financial benefit for that. You know, in a sense, like hawking the family silver, you know, for cash today, but then having to go, you know, lease it back in the future. I don't know the precise deals, but that seems like a local public policy failure more than like a broad trend. And I actually think cities, if they're not getting out of that game, should get out of that game. You know, part of what we're advocating for is like, hey, if you have these big sites that you're trying to redevelop, Pruitt-Igoe or here in St. Paul, they've been dealing with this this Ford site a lot. You know, our position on that has been the worst thing you can do is talk to one developer. You know, the worst thing you can do is have one big person that you're dealing with go and split this thing up, you know, start that ecosystem at the local level again. And when I read this article, when I looked at this, the thing that I drew away from it, and this kind of gets to that tech jobs part, is that you have a market for people who want to go in and take these, instead of having a big public policy thing where we sell off blocks at a time, there's actually now a workforce with the capacity to go in places and buy up these things individually, make them into something worth living in. And then, you know, because of kind of the expensiveness of Silicon Valley and other places, and just, I think, the proliferation of tech jobs in general across the landscape, you can live a really high quality of life in a city like St. Louis or Cleveland.
Oh, yeah.
On a, you know, comparatively tiny income in the tech sphere. And I think these houses are like the transition to make some of that possible.
Oh, I totally agree. And you're right. We didn't really talk about the slant of this article, which is that we have more and more tech companies moving into these Rust Belt cities as the cost of living in San Francisco et al. Has exploded. That's certainly happening in St. Louis too. I think the one thing that I would say, and this isn't really something that I even want to see attacked with policy or anything else, is I hope that flippers in the Midwest are being strategic, thoughtful, and humble about the way that they do this. One thing that the article pointed out, I'll just cut right to the chase. They didn't point out very well, was that while these buildings have a really high rate of return in the Rust Belt, they have a much lower dollar return per project because the starting costs are so cheap. And, you know, it is very unusual to buy a single family home in St. Louis for more than $250,000. It's going to be a pretty dang nice home. Right. It's going to cost that much.
You can literally, let me put some math to this.
Yeah.
Cause I've seen in places like Akron where, you know, you can buy a house for $50,000. You can put another $50,000 into it and then sell it for $200,000. And that extra $100,000 increment is not only profit, but it's also compensation for your risk and your time and the effort and the, you know, the sweat equity you're putting into it.
Absolutely. And the point I'm trying to make, though, is that $100,000 increment is going to be smaller than what you're going to get in a Miami or a Las Vegas for the most part. So flippers tend to work at volume. They work at scale. And I would love to see a generation of Strongtown's advocate house flippers who are thinking strategically about where to concentrate their investment, not all on the same block, not flipping every single house to the exact same state at the exact same time. If it can be a more personal, organic, soulful process, I'm all for it. It isn't always that way.
I don't see it that way. And I guess when I look at like, and let's just take Vegas or Phoenix as like the house flipper market. To me, when I looked at like the house flipping going on in those markets, it was basically people who knew nothing about housing, who knew nothing about, you know, fixing a place up and keeping it running or making it, you know, better. All they were doing for the most part was counting on market appreciation to drive their profits. They were basically like speculators. They were land speculators. And right. To me, those are the ones that are being done on volume. I mean, those are the ones where if you got the real estate investment trust getting the, you know, the liquidity in Wall Street, you're pumping it into something that you can do on volume, and you're counting on basically like the rising tide of home prices in a fast growing, you know, in a rising market to give you 10, 15, 20% returns year over year. That's way different than like buying low and putting your own equity and, you know, your own sweat into a building to improve and then gaining from, you know, the neighborhood improvement as well. Yes, the one is a volume, but the other one is you know, an individual. If you're an individual and you can make $60,000 a year, you know, flipping homes, renovating two or three and turning them around and selling one every 6 months, you can make a really good living doing that for a long, long time. That was not possible back in the 90s and early 2000s. You could not compete in that market as an individual. I think you can today. And that's what I'm most excited about.
Yeah, I see that. And, you know, I want to say I agree with you. I want that to be true. I know people who are doing it. I just think there's a much wider spectrum between the honest house flipper and the land speculator than sometimes it might seem like there are. There are people that buy dirt cheap land in St. Louis with houses on them that they have no intention of servicing or improving in any way. And they sit on them for years, even though they're seeing no return. They aren't profiting on a market that's improving incrementally over time or that's even taking off. They are sitting on it in hopes that something really big is going to come along. And that's something that has shocked me as I've moved into my own real estate practice. And it's just something that I want to acknowledge exists as we have this conversation.
Yeah, yeah. No, I hear you.
So that was good. Thank you, Chuck. I'm glad that we can talk about some stuff that we disagree on so respectfully, because this is a really important topic that has real implications for our community.
Oh, you don't see. I've been drawing mean doodles of you the whole time.
Yeah, I'm just like on fire. A little pencil.
Just kidding. It is interesting to me, though, how, you know, because you grew up in the Cleveland area and St. Louis, and I think you are more in touch with like the gritty than I am. I grew up in a small town. And, you know, in a state where I think Minneapolis and St. Paul are kind of certainly, you know, during the last half of my life have been rising up really strongly and kind of had maybe more in common with what's going on in Seattle and Portland and Denver than what's going on in St. Louis and Cleveland. Right. So, I respect certainly your point of view. I do think that these Rust Belt cities have what I've kind of associated with like old school unionism, and I know that's not right. That's not like the right way to think about it. But like Duluth has this where like, if you're going to do anything in Duluth, you've got to deal with all this bureaucracy, all this red tape, the good old boys network, you know, the head union officials. There's like a whole litany of people. And I do get that sense in St. Louis that because of the that aspect of it, it tends to be more like a New York kind of city where you've got kind of like the machine that you got to work through, as opposed to like a Northwestern city, where I think things are a lot more democratic and because a lot more chaotic too at times.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I'd love to talk to you about the cultural differences between these places on a later podcast, but let's go to the down zone real quick. I'm curious what you've been reading lately and anything unrelated to what we just talked about that has kind of got you interested. Any TV shows that are exciting to you right now? Hit me.
That's really funny you would ask that. I actually had someone recommend Extant, this TV show, and it's like it's a little sci-fi-ish, really good. I went through the whole first season, and there were a couple moments where I'm like, yeah, no, but it was really good. Not like Star Trek, Star Wars-ish, but more like you know, a alien kind of. I don't want to use the word invasion, but like aliens coming in and kind of integrating into society. It was interesting. I'm also going through the book called The Value of Everything by Mariana Mazzucato. I read an article that she wrote. I thought it was interesting. I thought I'd check out the book, not really with the book, but I'm going to finish it. I'm pretty close. And I don't know, another perspective worth thinking about, I think.
Yeah. Well, I've been kind of stepping outside of my work life a little bit and into my other work life. You know, Chuck, that I'm a novelist.
Yes.
In addition to doing what I do for Strong Towns, I tell people all the time that I'm the rare lucky person who's super passionate about two things that have nothing to do with each other. And I get to do both of them for money, and I'm kind of living my best life. But I've been reading some of the books from the National Book Award longlist for fiction. And one I just read that I thought maybe Strong Towns fans would like was Florida by Lauren Groff. It's a collection of short stories. All of the characters are either from or have some connection to Florida. And it sort of like in a very oblique way talks about the culture of that place, which I think is fascinating. And I find it really useful to me in my work as a Strong Towns advocate to sometimes just like step outside of it and read some good stories that are based in place and kind of remember what it's all for. So that's my recommendation, Florida by Lauren Groff.
So that's a fiction book.
Yeah, short stories.
Short stories. Okay. Maybe I'll read that. It's really interesting to me because I think you know that like if I read fiction, it's always like a spy novel or something like that.
Yeah.
Like you guys had me read some fiction thing earlier and I'm like, what is this? It's just like not my kind of thing. It's interesting because I read probably 90% nonfiction. I would be interested to see what Kia's recommendation would be like on something like this.
They're very eclectic because, as you know, I read a lot of fiction, a lot of nonfiction, a lot in general. I'm that nerd who keeps a spreadsheet of everything I read and I count every year. And this year I'm on track to crack like 100 books. So knock on wood, I'll get there. Last year I fell down. So gotta get back on the horse.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think last year I thought I was going to fall under the 50 mark and I wound up at like 56. So you're like double me. So we're good.
Right. I read a lot of poetry too, to be fair. So skinny little books. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you so much for listening to Upzoned. If you haven't yet, be sure to check out our Strong Towns Plano gathering for North Texas. That's going to be October 3rd, kicking off with a curbside chat at UT Arlington and proceeding into 2 days of transformative, awesome events that I cannot wait for. You can buy tickets at strongtowns.org/Texas-gathering. Don't spell out the word hyphen. You know what to do. Thanks so much for listening, and we will see you next week in the episode.